This is Geek Speak, episode 35 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah. And it's curmudgeon, actually.
What'd I say last
time? He said curmudgeon. But I'm Miles, curmudgeon. This is really what you should be doing. You're the pedant. I'm the vice president of the pedantic society.
And your name is Ben Jaffe, and sometimes you're a programmer, a musician, a video geek, and you used to be a world traveler, and I see that it's back.
Not this last weekend, but the weekend before, I went to Iceland for a destination wedding of a good friend of mine. Mission accomplished. He got married, and I got to see Iceland in a way I hadn't before. I've been there once before and kind of bounced around the island, but we hadn't done the like geothermal pools and all that kind of stuff. It was really fascinating. So one thing that we did is we hiked out to these geothermal pools, but they weren't actually pools. It was a river. Oh. So this river was flowing, and then there was this little hole in the ground, and from this hole was literally boiling water. Like, it was bubbling and boiling coming out of this hole and mixing with the cold water and making the river really, 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 really hot. One really cool thing about that is around the hole, the rock that made up the hole was scorched because it's got boiling water constantly coming out of it. So it's this like dark, dark red and kind of faded to orange.
How do you know in that situation whether it's safe to be in the water or not?
You try and poach an egg and see if it if it works.
Everyone carries eggs.
No, what we actually did is we walked a little bit further down the river. And the entire river, it's just winding river through this beautiful Icelandic landscape. And it's just steaming because it's really hot water. And so, you know, the steam is coming off. And you could decide the temperature that you wanted by how far away from the source you went.
That's pretty cool.
It was really, really neat. Yeah.
Have you done a lot of hot springs?
I have not. I've gone to Harbin Hot Springs, which is up a little bit north of here. It's
yeah,
a
California.
Couple hour drives. Yeah. But I've never, it never even crossed my mind that there would be such a thing as a hot spring river. Like, I don't even know what to call it. Like,
yeah, I don't think it's that uncommon. I have seen creeks and stuff that would be
hot springs.
It makes
a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does make sense.
The water would be flowing, but right. I've never seen that. It was amazing.
It's cool.
And then the other thing is when we were walking back to the bus that drove us out there, we were walking on the moss that had grown on the volcanic rocks. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really, really thick, and it felt like memory foam. And so we actually stopped and laid down for a little while, and it just felt like a really, really lumpy memory foam mattress.
So much so that when you put your footprint in, you lift it up, it kind of...
It bounces back, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, like you don't leave footprints because the moss is like, okay, whatever.
Did you go into any city areas of Iceland?
Yeah, we hung out in Reykjavik, and there's...
It's like the only city I know of in
fantastic Airbnb there. But yeah, right. Iceland is amazing. It's also really interesting to see how tourism has affected the city. My partner and I were there a year ago, and then we just went back 2 weekends ago. But if you look at the graph of the number of tourists in Iceland here, I'm showing it
You'll
to
have
you right
now. Geekspeak.org.
Go ahead and, or you could just look it up on Wikipedia.
Well, what happened?
It looks like a hockey stick.
In 2000, it just started going up seriously.
Yep. It kind of looks like the quintessential hockey stick graph. And this is a projection to 2020, but it goes through the top through 1 million like a couple years ago. So,
and you were two of those people, four of those people.
Yeah, we were a couple of those people.
Cool. So you recommend?
I recommend it.
Tourists wanting to say, where is this place that after the world financial crisis, they actually prosecuted the banks?
Did they?
And yeah. And
who did? Iceland?
Iceland. Yeah. They instead of putting in austerity measures and the like, they just went like, nope, we're defaulting. And the banks, yeah, you're going defunct. And the heads of the banks, yeah, you're going to jail.
Oh, wow. That's kind of cool.
How did their economy do after that?
I recovered quite nicely, as a matter of fact. The thing is, though, that there was a lot of outside investment. And so there were places like the UK that weren't too happy with the fact that they defaulted on their debts. But at the same time, the amount of money that comprises the Icelandic economy is so minuscule compared to the UK economy, it mm-hmm. really didn't matter. It was more a matter of principle rather than a matter of money making an issue.
And sure.
Was that around the same time that their volcano exploded and shut down flights?
No, that was later, I think.
That was later?
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about the 2009 financial
yeah.
crisis. Because I remember they were having I think they were having financial difficulties around the same time that their ground was exploding. It's a very unhappy coincidence of timing.
Miles, tell us about Gawker.
Gawker is a magazine that many of us love to hate. Because
why do we hate it?
Well, when it started off, it was very much a clickbait, try to get an inflammatory headline, and whoever happened to get hurt, oh well, which is actually what got them into trouble in the first place because they went after billionaire Peter Thiel, who ended up having a grudge against them. Peter Thiel was outed as gay. On the site.
By Gawker?
On ValleyWag, which is an associated site. Gawker is now an umbrella of sites, or was an umbrella of sites.
Is ValleyWag a Silicon Valley
yeah.
focused one?
Oh, okay. Good. Okay.
And so then when they got into the mix with Hulk Hogan, and Hulk Hogan sued them for libel, Peter Thiel bankrolled that litigation so as to bleed Gawker dry.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It was quite
revenge.
Public and
yeah.
Very upsetting to a lot of people that if a billionaire doesn't like what you say, that they can just bleed you dry, whether or not the case has a lot of merit.
Have I seen Gawker headlines, clickbaits? Are those been Gawker frequently?
It depends. I mean, Gawker in and of itself has matured over the years. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, it was a lot more sensational. It actually ends up being a lot more relaxed nowadays. Or whenever I'd seen articles, they didn't have the same. I don't know, I'm trying to use a word that I can use safely on the podcast without having the illicit symbol on it. But you have things like Gizmodo, Deadspin, Jezebel, Lifehacker, Kotaku, Jalopnik. All of these are the Gawker company.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Or
they
Gawker,
own a lot.
Gawker Media.
I love Ars Technica's headline on this article that you've cited. Body slammed by Hulk Hogan. Gawker.com will cease operations.
Right. The website is going to be going dark soon. And the property was purchased at auction by Univision.
Right. For like $140 million. Not a lot.
$135 million.
$135 million, yeah. So we'll probably see the people that have worked there that have been doing that continue to do work in some fashion. Not everybody necessarily is going to get laid off because of the purchase. Because, of course, when you buy out a property like that, you actually are buying out any of the tech they have, any of the
yeah.
trademarks they have, but also hopefully staff.
Yeah. Gawker was facing a $140 million jury verdict. So $135 million is pretty close to that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that kind of interesting news. I guess it's not going to necessarily affect me seriously. I think it's one of those things that I think as geeks we've joked about their headlines and kind of laughed them off. And but in any case,
yeah, and that's why people have been back and forth about it. Like they don't like Gawker, but they didn't like the case either.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like yeah. the frat boy mentality that was Gawker trying to go into news. But at the same time, like I said, that notion of a billionaire can say I don't like the story that was posted, so I'm going to work behind the scenes to ruin them.
A little crappy. Ben, have you heard of the Spruce Goose?
What's a Spruce Goose?
What?
It sounds like an alcoholic drink.
No, it's actually one of the largest airplanes ever made.
Yeah. You've never...
Oh, that's
propeller,
funny.
Propeller airplanes.
Oh, okay.
It's
that
made
might
by
be
Hughes.
Why.
And he was kind of, I think, almost insane at the point of making, or at least people said that, because there's no way it would fly. It actually did have a flight, a very short flight. It's 219 feet in length and a wingspan of 320 feet. That's
if
the
you
biggest
had,
propeller airplane ever to fly. If you
now,
will.
If you had referred to it by its official name, the Hughes H-4 Hercules.
Oh,
of
you would have known that.
Of course. No, I don't. Why are you asking me that?
Because of your headline of your next story.
Okay. Yeah. The headline of my next story is the world's largest aircraft, new largest aircraft, is now flying. It, or not now flying, but it did spend 20 minutes in the air just last week, which is kind of exciting. This, I'll tell you guys about it, but first I just have to tell you a couple things that I learned on my Wikipedia deep dive that, of course, ensued when you start looking at the length of aircraft and you start coming up with all these crazy things. So the Spruce Goose is listed on this Wikipedia page of list of large aircraft. Nice. Of course, this exists. And it's way down in the experimental and prototypes. And the Spruce Goose also was like 1947 was its first flight. So long time ago. So the largest airplane in the world until now has been the Antonov AN-225, which I clicked on. I read around on this page, and this is just an insanely huge aircraft. It's 84 meters long, so that's 275 feet. Wingspan is 290 feet, so it's actually wider than it is long, and it's 60 feet high almost.
Ukrainian.
Yeah, and it's just – it's insane. It also goes at a maximum speed of 528 miles an hour. Cruising speed is around 500,
and it's still flying,
and it's just tremendous and huge. I also found out about the
– Did you look at the wheel design of that craft?
Yeah, it's insane. It has like
– 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7
times two
on each side.
So that's 14 wheels on the left of the main landing gear.
Wow. Okay, so go back to the new craft you're talking about.
Anyway, actually, I got to tell you one more, which I found really interesting, which is the Bristol Type 167 Brabazon. I have never said that in my life before. First flight, 1949. It was a large propeller-driven aircraft. It was designed to fly transatlantic routes, but it was designed also to only, despite its size, carry 100 passengers.
Oh.
And each of those people would have the room of the entire interior of a small car. And that was their model. And it did not work. They only made the prototype. And I don't believe that plane is still flying.
The Antonov An-225 Mirya that we talked about first can fly 640
tons.
That is a lot of flight.
Yeah.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So the world's new largest aircraft in the world. Now, we're thinking planes here, right? This is a plane helicopter dirigible thing.
Does it make the list?
It's not a plane. It is an airship.
An airship. Yeah. It kind of looks like a blimp with wings or fins and props for propulsion. Where is it? Hold on a second. There it is. The aircraft's odd shape has led some observers to describe it as a, quote, flying bum.
So, as in a buttocks.
As in a buttocks. Anyway, it flew for about 20 minutes. It is 300 feet long, so it's about 50 feet longer than all of the other planes that we were just talking about.
But how does it stay in the air?
How does it stay in the air? Helium. A whole bunch of helium. So it doesn't actually have any internal structure. It's held up, or it's kept in the shape that it is by the pressure of the helium inside the hole. And the hole is made from carbon fiber. Oh. So it's a very lightweight aircraft as these things go.
Is it a lighter than aircraft?
No, I don't. Well, yes,
when it's flying,
it would be.
Yeah,
when it's when
unless
flying.
It has propellers as well, that's always using lift. That you can technically be heavier than air.
From what I understand, it is a lighter than air aircraft.
Yeah, although this article doesn't say for certain, but it seems like it does. This one can carry up to 10 tons of cargo, which is much smaller than the number of the other plane, right?
Probably more efficiently.
Much more efficiently. Maximum speed of 91 miles an hour, which is much slower than the other craft, but surprisingly fast for a blimp. And actually, it was originally designed for U.S. military surveillance because it can stay up in the air unmanned for a really, really, really long time.
What's its cargo? I mean, how many people? Is it an aircraft for people transport?
It's kind of slow. No. It's. I don't think it's meant for people transport. If it's manned, this article says it can stay up for 5 days at a time. But if it's unmanned, it can stay for over 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Up in the air without landing.
So airships, large airships, in 1929, the HM Airship R-100, which was 220 meters long, mm-hmm. even longer than that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, it's because it's a dirigible airship thing, it can operate from the water if we wanted to. It doesn't need a runway.
Right.
Which is really nice.
Come above a building and drop a ladder.
You can make an emergency landing wherever you want.
I think it would be fantastic if that became a regular thing again. We actually saw airships.
Dirigible, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Maybe cargo delivery, because it's slow, but it's relatively efficient.
It's like a barge of the sky.
Wouldn't it be cool?
That would be really cool.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Of course, I like trains. So, but then again, these things move where trains can't move.
It'd be faster than a lot of trains, yeah, to be honest. Yeah. But it'd be faster than a lot of trucks as well.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Like twice as fast... And almost twice as fast on a highway, and it can go as the crow flies, as opposed to following the road systems, which are not always a direct path to where you want to get.
Going up and down hills and mountains and stuff. Mm. Yeah. I don't know. It just seems like a generally good idea. Actually, it always seemed like a ridiculous idea that airplanes have to exert a bunch of energy just to stay aloft, basically, mm-hmm. right? They're always fighting gravity, whereas dirigibles or blimps, airships, generally are not, because they have lighter-than-air in them.
They just use the atmosphere. Awesome. Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
Miles, hi.
Yeah, speaking of hot air. Oh.
actually, helium, not necessarily hot.
But, yeah, true.
But we are running out of helium.
We actually have come across new deposits that take care of the helium problem as it exists right now. It is a non-renewable resource.
Yes, yeah. And it does escape the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike most things we have, because of its nobility, it doesn't bond with anything and it just goes.
Nobility.
Yes, it's a noble gas.
Okay.
It is the lightest,
the
least massive noble gas. Ends up in our upper atmosphere, and then the solar winds just take it on away.
Bye bye helium.
So other things that can get you up is hot air. Well, good thing is we have a lot of it. So last September, hottest September ever. Last October, hottest October ever. November, hottest November. December, hottest December, January, February, on through July.
What about April?
Hottest of each month ever recorded.
Mm-hmm.
July, usually being the hottest month of the year, was the hottest month ever of any month.
Sure. Because it was hotter than itself the previous year, and it's normally the hottest because of the shape of our continents.
Yes. It's been a world record year.
Yay.
Solid.
It's kind of depressing.
So once again, we've talked about global warming in the past.
Or global climate change.
Yes.
You know, we talk a lot about the dangers of fracking and, you know, a bit about the concerns. There's a lot of hyperbole about the concerns of fracking. And it's just become a bad word. The K has been added to it, even though it's really not part of the original term for fracking, whatever the fracking stands for. But one of the things that's kind of disturbing about fracking is it's made oil a lot cheaper and therefore greenhouse gases being produced quicker.
Although natural gas has displaced a lot of other sources like coal.
But keep in mind that when they did fracking, natural gas is where it was first formed, but now fracking is also used for crude oil development. So it's producing more and cheaper carbon.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is not good from the perspective of global warming. But good if you want to drive a gas car.
Or if you want earthquakes in Oklahoma.
Can we talk about something more optimistic?
Oh, sure. Yeah. There is a new port of call, as they say, installed at the space station, the International Space Station.
What do you mean new port of call? Like they're inviting people?
Higher and higher in terms of things that are transporting people. Yeah, they attached the first of two planned international docking adapters. So other agencies, private industry, whoever could just fly on in and dock with them a lot more easily. So,
it's so funny. On a space station, you actually design a door specifically for new guests.
Yeah. This is your door.
That's
Use
cool.
this door.
Why'd they do this in the sense that there's already ports there? Why not keep like the standards? Are they updating because, you know, technology shifts, they want different qualities about them? Or is there already standards?
That I don't know.
Interesting.
That I don't know. Yeah.
I guess from my perspective, I was going to make a spacecraft that wanted to dock. I'd be like, how do those docking things that exist already work?
Yeah,
you want to invent a new one.
Well, one of the really interesting things about the International Space Station is that it's kind of like playing with Legos in a sense. You know, like they've designed all of these different pieces of the space station to in such a way where they can connect up to other parts really easily. And so people have actually made animations showing the progression of all of the different modules. So they'll send up a module to the International Space Station, they'll connect it, they'll send up another module, but then there won't be a spot for it. So they'll move this module over here, and then they'll move this module over to this door, and then they'll have a space for this new module. And they actually do that quite a bit. It's really interesting just kind of to see. It's like real world Legos with really horrible consequences if things go wrong, right? Yeah. Also, they had to do a spacewalk. Actually, the two of the U.S. astronauts up there did a spacewalk to install this. They got it in place with a robotic arm, and then they spent a couple hours tying it down and connecting power and data cables for the new adapters. So yeah, that's good.
I think I'm going to mention a Wikipedia site that I just landed on called Docking and Berthing of Spacecraft. And it is a list of all the different ways crafts in space can dock and berth together.
Really cool.
And they have a very long list. And some, you know, they've got a column for internal crew transfer. And it's no, yes, no, no. You know, some of them are designed for
wow.
crew, some of them are not. And then one of the columns I love is type, non-androgynous or androgynous.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
Which is pretty cool because how do you make an androgynous docking station?
Same goes for trains as well. Trains have androgynous connectors where you can take either part of either of the cars you want to connect and just
push them together,
slide them together, and they connect because of the way that it's built. And actually, the secret, I was thinking about this before I actually looked it up. I'm like, how on earth would you design something like that? And the way that they designed it for trains is they took advantage of the fact that when you have two things that are coming together, the first one, its right is different from the other one.
Right.
Its right is the other one's left. And so you've got a kind of side to side mirroring. And mm-hmm. so you can have these things come together next to each other and then connect up.
And most space docking ports, of course, have to somehow seal perfectly airtight. So
yeah.
It can't just be a left, right, left, right.
It
thing,
can't
right?
be, yeah.
Yeah. Really cool. Anyway, you can read up on these docking stations. Cool. Very cool. We'll put up a Geek Speak.
Yeah,
as well.
You know, this entire episode so far, it could just be an ad for Wikipedia.
Yeah, like, it's true.
We really need Wikipedia. You should donate to Wikipedia. No, I'm kidding.
So last week, I was looking at different podcasting apps that actually put show notes in the podcasting feed. And we, for a long time, have just been using an RSS
yeah.
segment called Description.
So how does that work? Because, like, so I go to iTunes, right, and I subscribe to GeekSpeak, and then I get a feed of episodes. And some of the podcasts I subscribe to have a description field, and some of them don't.
That's right. Well, almost everybody has a description field. But the description field, specifically, it's going to be in an XML document because, of course, RSS is XML.
Right.
And,
okay.
And iTunes or Apple actually specifies an iTunes namespace description field. And theirs, I think it's called Summary, you're not supposed to put any HTML fragments in it. You're only supposed to put text, if you will.
Okay. So you can't do things like bold text or make hyperlinks to other places or whatever.
That's right. No
Otherwise,
HTML fragments.
What do they just ignore it? They're like, no, that's
I don't know
HTML.
What they would do. I think that they might just print it as escaped characters.
Oh, I yeah. see. That's bad.
Ampersand LT semicolon.
That's right.
B.
Less than. So the other description field, because Apple did this kind of declaration, people have been free to put anything they want in the other description field. And so you can put URL or XML escaped HTML inside that text field. And I've never done that. When I generate the XML document, I strip out all the HTML fragments and just put text in because it felt like it was an XML document. I don't want to put junk in there. But I've been looking around, and most clients that actually use the description field actually render HTML as if they reparse it as HTML. So I went ahead and – I mean, it's easy to edit the GeekSpeak website. It's just a Rails app. And I went ahead and was like, well, I'll just put all the links that we collect into the RSS feed in the description field. So if you've got a good podcasting app, the description field now has links that we talk about are actually in the podcasting app. You can jump right to the page.
That's really interesting.
And if you don't have a good podcasting app, it's going to look like a bunch of garbage.
Yeah. If you do see it as garbage, I'd love to know what that client is. That would be nice to see. And I could actually potentially deliver different XML documents per client.
I have seen links in description fields, and I never stopped to think, how are they putting the link, which is HTML, it's basically XML, inside of an XML document? It's kind of weird.
Like, yeah, it is.
It feels like a wrong thing to do to put XML inside of XML.
Yeah.
In that way.
Yeah, and it is escaped. So
yeah.
In that sense, it's just text. So it really is up to the client. And so I'd assume, Miles, that a client that's kind of bad would just look like raw.
It'd be like you went to a website, you right-clicked on it, and chose View Source.
Yeah. A lot like that. That's okay, though. Whatever.
Cool.
Any case, so I'll put these links. They'll be in the podcast feed. You can take a look and click on the docking and berthing and whatever the one you just had for the space stations. Mm-hmm. Hi, Miles.
Hiya.
Let's talk about IPv4 and IPv6.
We've talked about it many times before. IPv4 is 32-bit. IPv6 is 128-bit.
And IPv4 and IPv4, IPv4 and IPv6, both of them are the way that IP addresses work. IP addresses are basically addresses for your computer or your home network or whatever it is.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Devices.
IPv4 allowing about, in theory, 4 billion, but a lot less than that in practice.
Okay, so IPv4, you can only have some number billion of addresses.
Right, which means
seemed like enough, 20 years ago, but not now.
Yeah. No one knew how big the internet was going to be when they created it, so yeah. They didn't know it was going to become a public network.
Right.
But yeah, there's not enough IPv4 addresses for all the people on the planet.
Yeah.
So they went to IPv6 and made it a 128-bit address, which is
– ungodly bigger.
Well – naively, you might think, oh, well, that's four times as big because it's four times as many bits. But no, It's every grain of sand on the planet gets 1,000 IPv6 addresses.
Is it really that big? You might be exaggerating. It might be 10 per grain of sand.
Yes. But literally every grain of sand on every beach on the planet could have its own IP address. And we'd still end up with a whole lot more.
All right. So what about it?
Well, we've passed a major milestone because one of the issues with IPv6 is that almost no one was using it for a long time. For 20 years, no one was
– even though it's been out there inspect and
– right, because people went, well, IPv4 is still out there, so we're just going to make do. Now we've run out of IPv4, so
it's got to happen.
The rubber's hit the road. And mobile networks, which is where a lot of IPv6 has come into play because there's so many new devices coming into play. Each person, which didn't have enough IP addresses per person, now has multiple devices that would have an IP address, a phone or two, a tablet, mm-hmm. Things like that. And Internet of Things, the other big driver of IPv6. Among major mobile U.S. networks, so your AT&Ts, your Verizons, your T-Mobiles, they now have passed the 50% IPv6 threshold where the mobile devices now support it.
Very cool.
More devices support IPv6 than don't support it.
Okay. Are they doing tunneling for when one of those devices wants to access IPv4?
It depends upon the device. More often what they're doing, I think anyway, is they would tunnel from a 6 to 4. Where the device has an IPv6 address, yeah. And then you
yeah, that's what I mean. Through. In the sense that if I wanted to go to a site that only had IPv4, could I do it on the
right.
IPv6 site?
The reason I bring it up is because, for example, Comcast for a long time, what it was doing was called a 4-to-6. You at your house have an IPv4 address, but if you try to access an IPv6, it would do that translation within their network and
for
go
you.
Out.
Yeah. Well, I've got to say that it makes sense that it would be the mobile industry because, of course, the mobile industry is very control with what kind of hardware hits their systems. They're going to approve certain phones and therefore when they're talking to a manufacturer, if they are their own manufacturer, they can say, hey, we want IPv6 support so that when the manufacturer does that, they make sure that whole model of phone comes online with IPv6, saving them IPv4 headaches.
Right.
Pretty neat.
Which also means we need to get on the ball about getting geekspeak.org onto IPv6.
Yes, sir. I'll get right on that. I've got a few other things on the list, but it'll definitely be there.
I got to say, I looked it up. Every grain of sand could have 3.4 times 10 to the 38. So that's 340 decillion. I don't even know how much that is.
How do you get the grains of sand count?
Well, I actually, so this is actually a Stack Exchange question. And one of the people said, well, no, grains of sand don't have any suitable networking hardware. But if you move past that, and then another person said that number, and then another person said, actually, it's really complicated because you don't actually get that many IP addresses because of these different reasons and whatever. But still, yes, every grain
and
of sand.
Please add that
to
the show notes.
But are they counting only the sand that is exposed to air, or are they also counting the sand that's buried and the sand that's underwater?
I don't know.
Oh, even especially surface sand,
especially underwater becomes. Underwater beaches end up being.
I always thought the best way to kind of assume grains of sand is just take the mass of the Earth and divide it by the mass of a grain of sand. You say that's the grains of sand of Earth.
You that, just assume that all of Earth is grains of sand?
Well, it could be one day.
That ends up being a very, very large number.
We're just talking about sand.
We're talking about stuff that's on the crust, not stuff that's the right, entire so mantle
let's take,
and
let's take
core.
The crust of Earth and break it into sand. Like that, to me,
but
just...
But Lyle, I'm not made of sand.
Yeah, but you're mostly a bag of water when it comes down to it. No offense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have enough for a solar system, it seems, with IPv6, but the latency will kill you.
Yeah.
Ben. You seem to be on a space kick today, so please don't stop.
I do. I've got a pretty cool story, which is that NASA recently announced that they will be releasing hundreds of peer-reviewed and scholarly articles on a whole bunch of research projects that they funded. And they're releasing all those online for free.
Nice.
For anybody, which is really cool. Really, really great.
I'm assuming these research projects at one point were published in different types of articles and journals and things of that nature, or were they internal?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think some of them were probably internal and some of them were probably paywalled. And I mean, we all have strong feelings about paywalls and how scientific research, generally speaking, should be open and available. NASA is doing that. And this is especially good for... any kind of privatized space agencies, because you know, think if you're trying to build a spacecraft, or you know, you need this information somehow. I mean, yeah. If you don't have access to it, if it's internal NASA only, I mean, you know, that makes sense. That's how it's always been. But this is changing things, and that's pretty amazing. And it's called PubSpace.
All right. Thank you, PubSpace. I'm assuming it's going to be some pubspace.nasa.org kind of thing.
Yeah.
But a Google search of PubSpace will probably do the trick.
So is that public space or published space? What's pub stand for?
I don't know. Pub, sub, hubbub?
I would assume public.
In 2013, the Obama administration made the request to increase public access to all federally funded research. So this is kind of the result of that, the fruit of that.
Yeah. And data.gov.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder if there'll be a link from there.
So you want to talk to us Miles about, thanks by the way Ben for that story.
Thank you.
I'm hoping that as that comes online you'll find interesting articles to bring on to Geekspeak about.
Yeah, actually all of the articles about this publishing are like, have you ever wanted to know about 400-foot tsunamis on wherever? Well, so they've definitely found some of the, you know, sexier ones, but there's just a lot of really good stuff there.
So, Miles, do tell us, what you want to talk about Blu-rays?
Yeah, I was going to talk about if you have too much money, it's burning a hole in your pocket, you got to spend it somewhere. Well, first off, you give it to us. But once you're done giving to us, then you might think about buying the $800 Lord of the Ring Blu-ray box set that looks like a eight set of bound volume books.
Please tell me there's something. Please tell me there's something else going on here.
Well,
besides just Blu-rays that look good in a box,
they look like bound books.
Oh my god, they really do.
They're leather and they're gilded.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it has each of the three Hobbit movies and each of the three Lord of the Rings movies, which as an aside, just as a quick footnote, I always found it interesting that the Lord of the Rings movies had so much content and they had trouble trimming it down. Like even the director's cuts, which are expansive and long, don't seem too long. Like if they added more stuff in, if they Tom Bombadil, if they added more stuff in, you wouldn't be necessarily upset. Whereas the Hobbit movies seemed like they were half a movie each that got stretched out.
Yeah, that was hard to watch.
I didn't watch the last Hobbit movie.
I watched the first one. I watched the first one and I stopped.
That's pretty bad, isn't it?
I saw all three of them. And yeah.
Did you like it?
They got progressively worse. It wasn't all bad.
We had a comment. It was Alex correcting you, Miles, on last week's episode. Do you remember the correction?
Yeah, the correction was that his did not have any wireless capability. It was just a keypad.
Specifically, his last week you covered a story about Bluetooth enabled deadbolts, and you said Alex Lias has one, and he wrote you back and said, "No, I don't."
Right, his was not wireless. It did still rely on batteries, but it had a deadbolt key associated with it as well, so that there was a fallback.
And he since removed it from his door, and now has a keyed door, I believe. And then he had something else too. One other correction. Do you remember where it is? I can't find it anywhere.
Oh, I don't remember another correction. So moving on, maybe he'll get back to us. Thanks.
Okay, well, I just want to say that if you are listening to GeekSpeak via some non-podcast catching software, but you use podcasts, please subscribe to our podcast. I love that you're listening via the website, and that's cool. Or, you know, someone opened a link on Facebook or something, and you're listening to an episode. That's awesome. But subscriptions actually help us quite a bit, so we get a feel for how many people are listening to us regularly. It helps us talk to sponsors. So please do subscribe to us. Okay, moving on. I think it is Ben's turn. And Ben, I believe that you're going to tell us all about software exploits.
Well, I'm not going to tell you all about it because this is not my area of expertise at all. And maybe you two can help me fill in the gaps. But the big thing is, so you'll often hear about exploits because, you know, someone wrote some bad software and, a hacker compromised someone's account because of a software exploit, right? But as it turns out, there's a whole talking about how software exploits are not needed to hack most organizations. Or rather, I should clarify that a bit, which is that the top ways that organizations are hacked is not via software exploits.
What is it normally?
It's mostly via stolen credentials.
Huh.
So the top five activities that they list, which I cannot explain beyond reading them, is the top one is abuse of weak domain user passwords, which is, you know, you have a weak password 12345, your account's likely to get hacked.
And if it's a domain, which means that you get access to one thing, you get access to all the things that user has access to.
Mm-hmm. So like if you compromise someone's Google account, you're going to compromise a bunch of different services. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Although in general, this refers to, for example, a Windows domain is the most common one where you log in. So you have access to all the printers, you have access to all the file servers.
Right. So that's not good. Also, there are four more, which I don't know. Maybe you guys know what these are. Broadcast name resolution poisoning, like WPAD.
WPAD? I believe that's a...
That's an acronym.
Okay. Oh, well, WPAD, yes.
WPAD, okay. Just got to say it right.
Oh, shoot. I used to know this.
Okay, that's something Miles used to know.
Web Proxy Discovery Protocol, or WPAD, is a technology which aids a web browser in automatically detecting the location of a PAC file using DNS or DHCP. PAC file?
So I don't know what PAC stands for, but that proxy detection means that you can say, I'm a new proxy, which means you can route all
traffic,
web traffic specifically, through a specific point, through your point, and become a man in the middle.
So you're trying to contact Lyle, and I say, oh, hey, I'm a proxy. You can put your traffic through me. And if I convince you, then all your traffic's going through me, and that means I can see your communication with Lyle and the rest of the world.
Or more to the fact, he's not asking specifically for Lyle. It's more along the lines of saying, hey, is there a proxy out there?
I see.
That's why it works, is because then you get to jump ahead and go like, Yeah,
it's
me. Oh,
yeah, that's me. I'm a proxy.
This is the whole idea of being on the same network as another user and being able to respond faster than the DHCP server or that provides DNS. So theoretically, you could get on a network, and even if you think you're talking to the rightful DNS and DHCP DNS entry from DHCP, you're actually talking to my DNS server.
All right.
I think this is the man limit.
Basically, that gives me the power to route any of your traffic to not safe places rather than safe places.
But see, it feels like that's an exploit. But I guess it's not an exploit in the sense that there's a bug. It's a protocol problem.
Well, that's an attack relating to the use of stolen credentials.
Okay.
Is what they're talking about here. The third one is local. Yeah. Third one is local admin password attacks or pass the hash attacks. Right. Number four is attacks on clear text passwords in memory. So if you reach into the computer's memory and you yank a password out while it's in the process of working with it, it might actually be in clear text.
An example of this, you run a different application on your computer, and that application then looks at the passwords in your browser or something's memory space.
Right. And then the fifth one is insufficient network segmentation.
Yes.
Does that one make sense to you?
This is a very big issue, and it's something that Alex and I just recorded an episode on. We'll be releasing in 2 weeks.
All right.
And this is all about the idea of if you have an untrusted device on your network and you have a trusted device as well, the untrusted device can do nasty things to the trusted device.
Oh.
And so you want to produce more segments of networks so that they can't talk to each other.
Oh, I see. Okay, interesting. In other words, you want to separate things.
Yep.
Okay. So anyway, if you're really into this, you can read the article. It's up on geekspeak.org, and the headline is ultimately that software exploits are not necessarily needed to hack most organizations.
It's not a hardware issue.
It's a meat space issue.
Yeah, it's not a hardware issue. It's not a software issue. It's a wetware issue.
A wetware issue, meaning humans, the ugly bags of water that sit at the computer and decide to use weak passwords and things like that, right? I mean, there's also a whole host of other ways to compromise an organization or someone's account via social engineering, where you call up and you say, oh my God, I forgot my password. Can you help me out? And the person who's not supposed to help you out helps you out anyway because they sympathize with you.
Yeah. We sometimes refer to it abusively as, the person is this weak link when you have bad passwords. At the same time, there needs to be some sympathy with regard to the fact the reason we have computers is because our brains are limited. So
this is true. This is true.
If our brains weren't limited and we could handle all of these things, we wouldn't need the computer.
Right. Yeah.
If you're interested more about social engineering, which of course is that layer where you're trying to get information for people to actually access a system, which is one of these ways of defeating security without dealing with problems with software. We have a very early episode of GeekSpeak, 2002, October 21st.
Whoa.
Episode is with Kevin Mitnick, and he's like a famous hacker. He wrote the book, The Art of Deception, Controlling the Human Element of Security. I think it's a half an hour long, because at that time, we were an hour long at that point. 2002? Yeah.
Were we?
I'm not sure. I have to find out. It's 5.3 megabytes. But it's 24 kilobits. It's really bad quality.
Oh.
But were you on the show?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Okay, cool. Anyway, it's old in our system, and Kevin was really interesting. He talked about some of his things he did too, actually. He talked about, hadn't done it. He talked about how one could do it, but obviously he hasn't.
This is only a year or so after he had been released from prison.
That's right.
Hacking, and he was known as the most notorious hacker out there for a while. It was a big to-do.
The world's most famous computer hacker and cyber cult hero, once the subject of a massive FBI manhunt for computer fraud, has written a blueprint for security based on his own experiences. That's kind of the lead into his book. Anyway, we'll link to that from this show, of course. That is the October 21st, 2002 episode of GeekSpeak. Really bad quality at that point in our lives, I think to say. Okay, can we talk about richness? And money?
Yes. The example of a person who would buy that $800 Blu-ray set and not worry about it.
Well,
would be Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Bill Gates, the richest person in the world. Apparently, in the last 2 weeks, his net worth, probably due to stock market fluctuations, has gone from $78 billion to now an estimated $90 billion.
That's a lot of money.
The most in the modern era.
Wow.
I mean, if you adjust for inflation, like the the Rockefellers were more were richer,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time,
gosh, they were richer billion. Than that.
Oh yeah,
wow.
And there are people in history, like Crassus of ancient Rome, who money adjust for inflation from ancient Rome. Yeah, he was wealthier than that. But at the same time, number two is $13.5 billion less.
That's a lot less.
Well, you know, it's not.
It's a few billion.
Yeah. A billion here, a billion there. Soon you're talking about real money.
Well, net worth, $90 billion. God, what do you do with that? I remember we used to talk about early on that.
You try to eradicate malaria is what you do.
Yes, and he's doing a good job of it,
he's
actually.
Doing, yeah.
Speaking of speaking of disease.
One last stat. He is – his net worth at $90 billion is equal to 0.5% of all U.S. GDP.
Wow. That's a lot. Speaking of getting rid of a disease, eradicating a disease completely, like Bill Gates is trying to do, Bill and Melinda Gates are trying to do with malaria, we had a passing of a famous scientist recently.
Yes,
we
did.
Or a medical professional. I don't know. A scientist? Doctor?
A doctor, yes. Dr. Donald A. Henderson.
I've never heard of this person. Sorry. Yeah,
which is a shame. It's kind of like Norman Borloff. You just don't hear the name very much.
Or Annie Gates. I mean, we could say anything we want here.
Yeah. But this particular doctor died at 87. And when we say like he helped to end smallpox, we don't mean, oh, he was some researcher who helped with a vaccine. He did. But he was also the person that really pushed in international circles and the World Health Organization to get the vaccine where it needed to be, including into war zones.
Wow.
Where they had a helicopter hijacked and had to get it back for ransom.
Wow.
So like middle of Civil War, it's just, yeah, but we have to still vaccinate people. And as of, I believe it was 1977, that's when they announced that smallpox was officially eradicated, was gone everywhere.
In the wild. We still have copies of it.
Yes. Global eradication was certified by the World Health Organization in 1979.
That is so cool. And that's all due to vaccinations?
Yes.
Wow. Did he help develop the vaccination or was he just the delivery person, the person that actually made the program?
I believe he did help with it, but okay. It was also an issue of there was a big push at the time where they didn't want to try to get rid of smallpox and fail. They were worried about the PR aspect mm-hmm. of it. A lot of international community were. And so they were saying, we'll go along with this if it's headed by an American who is willing to take the blame if everything goes south.
Yeah,
and that's a really tough place to be in. That is something that is not for the weak of heart.
Yeah.
And this is the guy that took up that mantle and said, I'll step up, and stuck with it and succeeded in eradicating smallpox. So this guy is not just some lab rat. Like, this is someone who really deserves the motto of or the mantle of hero.
Yeah. Very cool. His name again?
His name was, as I pull away from the page, Dr. Donald A. Henderson.
All right. Cool. Ben, let's talk about energy.
I want to talk about something that there are some new pictures of, and they are so beautiful. Have you ever seen an offshore wind turbine farm before?
Yeah, I think I've seen pictures of them.
Have you seen? Here's a picture of one right here. And basically, it's just a bunch of yellow platforms sticking just above the water. And then a bunch of these trunks attached to these wind turbines with three blades each and all that stuff. Two things. First of all, there's this article, which you can go to keyspace.org and take a look at the images as I'm talking about this. But
just imagine the wind farms you've seen. They're just sticking out of the ocean.
Yeah. So some of them are renderings and some of them are actual real ones. And you can't really tell which are which.
Of course not.
They're so beautiful and strange looking, like these things sticking up out of the water. But they're also absolutely massive. Like I'm going to show you one more picture.
Describe it.
Here, you describe it.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so it's a picture of a freeway with a semi truck. And instead of the semi-truck having a trailer of, you know, one trailer or two trailers or three trailers, it looks like about six trailer length, and that is one blade of the propeller of an air
of
windmill.
This thing.
That thing is huge.
It is
I would
tremendous.
Say 60 meters.
Yeah, they are just absolutely tremendous. And so this is a little photo gallery. It's probably largely for PR purposes, but
sure.
I'm perfectly happy with that because they're just beautiful, beautiful pictures. They had to pave some new roads, some fake roads, roads for transporting these things around tight turns mm-hmm. and everything. They transported them on barges out to the sea. And
that vehicle, of course, has steering in the front and the back, if
right,
you will.
Right.
I mean, it's a vehicle as much as it's a giant wing that has
that
a front and a back
two
wheels
vehicles,
on it.
Right. Yeah,
like telephone pole transport sometimes happens.
Yeah, definitely.
And fire trucks.
It's just a really stunning series of photos. And
well, definitely. It's one of those. Visit the website to see them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey.
Also, it's really interesting to see like how they installed these things. They had a crane, which was on a huge boat. Which was lifted out of the water so that way it wasn't so it was
stable
exactly, and then this crane would lift this tremendous blade up to attach to the actual
so cool.
The thing. It was just really, really interesting.
Hey Miles, I think last week you talked about new SSDs that were big.
SSD is solid state
right.
hard drives.
Is that was that last week that you talked about SSDs that were a big one coming? I think it was a
yes.
Multiple SSDs inside a big one, which is like 64 terabyte drive.
Well, all SSDs are multiple chips, so
sure.
Yes, they stacked more chips inside.
And then right after that, and at first I thought it was the same story. Is a whole story about Micron and Intel preparing to launch a completely new type of technology form that has amazingly cool transfer speeds and densities. And it should actually come out supposedly in 2017, beginning of the year, 2017. That's what they're saying. This thing – yeah.
I have to admit I'm not quite as bullish on it. Yes, it's yes, it is faster, but they talk about it's getting to be as approaching the speeds of DRAM speeds. But really what they're talking about is latency speeds, which is important, how quickly it can look up the information on the mm-hmm. drive. But it doesn't
have –
it isn't DRAM speeds in terms of throughput. To give you an idea of the discrepancy between what they're promising and what DRAM does, DRAM nowadays is on the order of, say, 25 gigabytes a second.
Yeah.
And – these SSDs, I mean, current SSDs, they top out at about 2.5 gigabytes.
Well, I think the whole idea of the DDR stuff being kind of like covering the idea that it's as fast as DDR in the latency aspect, and it could be, you know, the hard drive could be just the same as memory. There's a whole architectural problem with that that is beside the, like, it isn't part of the scope of what this is actually for. This is a hard drive replacement that's a lot faster.
Right.
It just happens to be, and it's hardware, of course, because it's non-volatile. And the speeds are so close to volatile RAM, that's what's so kind of amazing about it.
Non-volatile
for
means
latency.
You don't need constant power for it to continue operating.
Right.
Like you can shut it down like you shut down your computer and all your data is still there.
Right. And of course, your computer, when it restarts, has to the RAM itself is volatile, so it has to be reloaded, and that's what boot time is actually about, and reading from the hard drive. This is 10 times faster than current NAND and flash-based SSDs, which is pretty cool.
10 times faster in latency, not in transfer speed.
So what about transfer speed?
Transfer speed is still one-tenth the speed of DRAM.
Okay.
Just like current SSDs, like it bumps the number a bit, but it's not that much faster in throughput.
So if you're transferring 100,000 tiny files, that's going to be way, way faster. But if you're transferring one very, very large file, it's not actually going to be all that much faster.
Good point, because you're saying that the latency of looking up the address of every one of those files will add up.
Yeah.
Exactly. Are you sure that it's just latency that has been improved?
Yeah, so the discussion that we had actually on the
on our internal Slack channel,
if you
yeah.
actually went to read.
Well, that's kind of why I was discussing. Want to discuss?
Oh, come on,
I don't know if you know this, but most of our listeners don't actually read that, so
yeah,
that's why
yeah.
we're talking about it now.
Right. As a point of reference, just to get geeky, because this is geek speak.
Mm-hmm.
On a typical motherboard or main board, in the case of a laptop. You have what's called PCIe, and this is a memory bus, peripheral connect, or Peripheral component interconnect, I believe, is what PCI stood for, and then they had multiple iterations of that.
Slot that you can connect certain kinds of things.
It's what you plug in, like a video card for gaming, or you would plug in an Ethernet card, or something like that.
Got it.
And and that PCIe bus has slices. I guess best way to describe it. And each slice can do about in terms of the newest standard of that PCIe 3.0. You have about a gigabyte per second of bandwidth.
For each slice?
Yes.
Okay.
And they do talk about it actually as gigatexels, which is the amount that you can transfer minus the protocol overhead of dealing with PCIe.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I'm just going to simplify it and say 1 gigabyte because that's what people are used to.
Okay.
And the video cards, these gaming cards, which are ridiculously fast, mm-hmm. Being able to do 3D rendering on games that is approaching photorealism now in real time, use a by 16, so 16 slices of this. So mm-hmm. a theoretical 16 gigabytes per second.
Oh, okay. But each device uses one slice or – Or a device can use multiple slices.
A device can then partition to use all lanes. Actually, they're called lanes.
Oh, lanes. Yeah. Okay.
So you can use 16 lanes. Lanes would be like the metaphor of a road, like how wide is your highway that you can go down. And the SSDs that are being talked about right now are only being targeted for a by 4 lane,
mm-hmm.
Which means that they have a maximum
throughput.
Yeah, 3 to 4 gigabytes per second.
Right. But that's not the technology in the drive that they're talking about. That's the protocol
and the
technology.
Right.
And the bus. So couldn't they, if the stack inside the drive could actually go faster, couldn't they use an 8-lane instead of 4 lanes?
Well, the fastest drive that I'm aware of would be Samsung's Pro, and they work on a by-4, four-lane bus. And those are about 2.5 gigabytes per second.
But this new technology, this 3DX point, does not increase that capability?
If it does, it does not go that it's a multiple of, you know, or adding 50% onto that, if anything. Where it's really getting the speed is in latencies.
Take a look at this. This is like a analysis of this stuff with how much faster it is by latency and also by throughput. And to me, this chart looks like the throughput.
That's not throughput. That's saying I/O operations per second, not the amount of data it's transferring, but how many operations it can do.
Is that okay? I see. So those two things are still not throughput.
Right.
Gotcha. Cool. All right. Thanks, Miles, for being so on top of this story. I think we actually have one more story today. So we should start it. Ben?
We do?
Oh, no. We don't. That's it.
Yeah,
we're done.
I'll take one.
All right.
So
I'm giving mine to Miles.
So I was talking with Didi about her Super NES. She has an old computer gaming system, and she liked it. And I was discussing with her about using a Raspberry Pi for it. And she's like, no, but I have the console, and I have the cartridges. I want to use that instead. And something that came up just recently in the news was someone making an NES, not a Super NES, but the original Nintendo Entertainment System console redesign. It costs $500.
What?
But it has it doesn't do a software emulator like most other things do. They actually have an actual chip that handles all of the hardware,
mm-hmm.
Handles all of the what would be normally an emulated hardware. And it does have output to HDMI, so you can hook up to a standard TV, whereas the older one you needed to have RCA out or the or connect up to the bunny wires for all of you who are old enough to know you needed a screwdriver to hook onto the coax. And
so this new one's not doing it that way.
Right. And it has USB for the controllers as opposed to the original one.
But not then wireless controllers?
Oh, I'm sorry. They have wireless controllers. I'm sorry. You were right. And Didi countered with, but for $8, I could just get a new connector and use
your existing unit.
Use a new controller with the old NES. Yeah, anyway,
that's kind of cool, though.
Which had me thinking. I was like, well, how much does a new NES cost? And it turns out you can get a used one for $50 to $100, like an actual NES. And a Super NES, you know, that one will go for, well, not much more.
Miles, the newer unit, though, that is HDMI and stuff, you don't have to deal with HAL to get RCA into your computer, into your system. Even though most TVs have RCA video in. Like, that's common. Why not keep it there? But I do think that having a newer unit that is potentially smaller and more durable, also, well, it's probably going to have an external power supply, which is not
– She nice. Had Didi had the issue of she has the cartridges. She has the system. So she has that nostalgia about the cartridge plugging it in.
It's kind of cool.
Whereas I take the tact of what a lot of people have for their home theater PC, which is I just want to have the ROM on – because each of those things is, you know, is a big cartridge that only takes up like 50 kilobytes of actual program data or something along those lines. So that's a lot of game. You could have every Super NES game ever made fit on one of the smallest SD cards that you can buy today of 4 gigabytes, like just as an afterthought.
But the tactile, you know, it's all pretty. It's got stickers on it. Hey, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, who's used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means use our stuff anyway you'd like it. Just let them know we said hello. Thanks to our patrons, and thanks to our intern Chandler and our support geek Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title, Bill Gates Gawks at Giant Aircraft. I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Has not a lot of space in there. Maybe Spacey Bill Gates or Space Gates? Space Gates Gawks at Giant Aircraft is cool. We'll see. Also, thank you to Michael Newman of PetStar Music, who provided our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 35 of our season 16. Miles, Elon, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Lyle Troxel.
See you next week.
So I got a Raspberry Pi 3 to be a server in my house and act as a platform to have a model of the GeekSpeak site. But a funny thing happened to me. I realized that I don't want to have a compiler on this box that I have as basically a production system.
Miles, Raspberry Pi is not a production system.
It can be. Okay, a Raspberry I want you to think about 10 years ago.
You're trying to harden the security of your Raspberry Pi so that no one comes in and like builds up.
10 years ago, the full computers, the full servers were as fast as that Raspberry Pi.
10 years ago?
10, 15 years ago, yeah.
20 years ago. Okay, anyway.
No, not 20.
50 years ago.
No, 10, 15 years ago. That's, you know, a gig of RAM, a 1.2 gigahertz processor.
So what's your solution then? Are you going to like get a Mac Mini to do your dev work on and then put it on your server?
No, I'm getting another Raspberry Pi 3. See, the thing is, I'm going to have my build environment be the same thing as my push environment.
Do you know about like containers and virtualization?
Yes, but do you know how difficult it is to do the virtualization in containers on an ARM64?
Ooh.
Yes, get my cross-compiler. Yes, let me have QEMU running. Yes, let me worry that there's going to be some difference in the emulation.
QEMU, really? You still use that?
I'm sorry. How are you going to do a virtual Raspberry Pi on a Mac?
Oh, my God, you guys. I can't even. What are you talking about?
Sorry. Is QEMU still the de facto standard for container-type virtualization? Really?
Well, for virtualization... Well, mm-hmm. For things that you
for
are
– file system virtualization.
For full emulation. So not virtualization but emulation. Inside of our Macs, inside of most Windows PCs, and like you have an Intel chip. So an x86, AMD 64, you know, that architecture.
Sure.
And then you have the Raspberry Pis and many phones and stuff like that. And they use an ARM architecture, different company, different register set. Looks completely different from the programmer standpoint at the assembly language. The C level, it's much the same. So you can't just take programs from one go to the other. For example, if I'm doing virtual computers on my laptop, let's say I'm running VirtualBox and I have three different virtual machines running, all of them are going to be the same CPU architecture as the host that I'm
so running. Virtualization is actually non-translation. It's not modifying the runtime to make it look like a different piece of hardware.
Right.
Emulation does that.
And in fact, newer CPUs have the ability to – they know that virtualization is going on and they have taken steps to make it easier for you to – for
hence the growth of all this container kind of right. concepts.
In terms of speed is wonderful.
Emulation though is the emulation of a different piece of hardware.
Right.
So you could run an emulated NES on your ARM64 processor of the Raspberry Pi.
Exactly. And it is much slower.
Sure.
Because you have to do the translation level.
So, Miles, my comment was, why are you on ARM? Why aren't you just on your machine?
Because that Raspberry Pi that I have sitting acting as a server inside my house takes up about 1 watt.
I see. That's a good reason. Are you going to build the software out so I can buy one and throw it on there and have a copy of the GeekSpeak site running on my Raspberry Pi? Are you going to make this easy for me to do?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, get it done, and then you just clone the SD card and pass it over. Yeah.
That'll be hard. My Drobobox that I've been using, playing with.
Drobobox. Drobo is like a box that you just put a bunch of hard drives in, and it's kind of like stupidly puts them together, right?
What do you call the best Drobo that's ever been made?
What?
Call Drobo.
Oh, God.
It's the after show. I get to do that. I get to do bad dad jokes.
I get to edit them out later. So last week, Dee Dee talked all about the NAS that she's been setting up and how she did that. And we have great links on the website for the stuff she's been using. Mm-hmm. I have a Drobo 5N, which is a network-attached Drobo. Drobo's normally been FireWire-type devices. This new one is a NAS.
All right.
And so my old Drobo, I actually pulled the drives out and put in this new one, which is a NAS. And I'm trying this out. This is actually given to me as a demo unit from Drobo. And I just haven't gotten around to doing it and talking about it on the show. But I have to say the platform itself can run Postgres, for example. You just turn it on, so you have a Postgres server running on my NAS, which can be up all the time anyway. So I'll be replicating from that. And tons of other things. Java 8 I installed so that I could run my Unify platform to run managing my network stuff.
See, here's where I'm thinking you may have jumped the shark. Just because I
said Java?
No, just because I think that home servers where you're doing computing is a separate and sometimes conflicting goal from a NAS.
I agree. I think the only reason I really thought of conflating the two is the simplicity aspect of that I want this thing on all the time. And it's not going to do much because it's serving files when I ask for them. So most of the time it's not going to do anything but maybe backups in the background. But lots of times it'll be just dormant. So having it every once in a while be up and run a job that goes and grabs a Postgres dump and copies the system, to me seems like a good use of it. It's not that I'll be running any – like it also has WordPress install on it. It's not like I'm going to do that kind of thing on it. Mm-hmm. But I agree that there's a limit to what you should use as a data storage system and what you should make more complicated.
I mean, this is the whole reason why I got a second Raspberry Pi, so that I wouldn't have build utilities. I wouldn't have GCC and make on the same
– You don't think so?
No, because if I am building on another box, I know that I can recreate something. I know that I haven't just had some random errant piece show up as part of my development process. So when I try to upload it to GitHub or send it to you, that it can still work. If I have it on a separate box and I get it working, then I bring it over to the quote-unquote production box and it works, I know that it will work on yours as well.
So you're talking about deploying to the production box. And so the scripts that actually make it all run are all part of the deployment cycle. So nothing has to be touched by hand. It just runs and it boots up a clean copy.
And that will know exactly which libraries are necessary.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I just want to say, wow, Drobo came a long way. I mean, Drobo used to just make a box that was pretty good at taking a bunch of hard drives and connecting them up and storing your data somehow, and you didn't really have to think about how. But yeah, it feels like they've really iterated on their product a lot in the last couple of years. That's good.
I do agree with Miles, though, that maybe they've gone too far. WordPress installed on it?
Well, although you have a choice, right? You can choose to enable that or choose not to enable that.
It's completely modular.
You could make the argument like you don't – there's some choices that you don't want to give the consumer. You could make that argument, but it doesn't come with WordPress already running or something.
Yeah, this would be a case where I would make a dedicated NAS, and then I'd have, for example, a Raspberry Pi that does computing, the computing aspect to it, and then maps the Drobo, for example, as a file share.
So one of the things that I want to be able to do with a machine that's on all the time is run a Minecraft server for my kids. And Minecraft server needs about 4 gigs of RAM to run effectively, and it needs a Java runtime. That on a Raspberry Pi, could I do that?
I have heard of people doing Minecraft on Raspberry Pis.
You can get away with 1 gig. It's just that as you do that, the user count decreases. But of course, you know, in a family home, that's probably not a problem because you're not going to have more than like 20 people over running at the same time. But I just wanted to kind of make sure to have it up. I don't know what my Drobo in 5N actually has for RAM. I'm assuming I could buy more. But it just kind of neat, these little things that I want to keep running all the time that I don't really want a dedicated machine, having one box to do that is pretty compelling to me. It also has quite a few BitTorrent clients in there. So you can actually put your BitTorrent files on there and have it do BitTorrent sharing and downloading.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Miles is showing us now a YouTube video of somebody running full Minecraft 1.89 running on a Raspberry Pi 3. Cool. How much RAM does the Raspberry Pi have? It's on the box right in front of you.
Yeah. I've kind of forgotten. It's not on the box.
That's because there's not a lot. But it's okay. I mean,
I think it's 512 megs. But
whoa, that would be really hard. I mean, you could maybe run on that. I've never run a Minecraft server less than 512.
I'm sorry. 1 gig.
Yeah. Okay. You could do it. You can do it with 1 gig, definitely. It would, you know, it's not the best performance, and you wouldn't want to be doing anything else with it, but that's fine.
1 gig and a reasonably fast GPU as well.
So the other thing this box does is a few different BitTorrent clients, so you can make your choice. And also they've opened up the platform so other people can write code for them. So it's got a lot of flexibility.
That's a cool move.
It also has 3 or 4 in the machine just ready to turn on. It actually downloads them, but they're like part of the menu. You don't have to like go and get a compiled thing and run source and all that. They have a few in there of things like media servers. So Plex media server, which is a pretty good media server. So I quickly booted them up and scanned some of the data because it's already on the drive. And that's one of those things, Miles, that seems like a good use for a NAS, the media server in your home. Because you want access to the files and you want access to them from your home. And the files are big. So you're going to have connected the NAS anyway to serve that file. Additionally,
But serving the file is a different problem than doing H.264 decoding or the like.
Yes, I get that. At the same time, if the machine is doing that and all it's doing is a hard drive server, its CPU is mostly idle anyway. So
not necessarily. Depends upon your file system.
So you would love a situation in which you had a file system NAS device and an external server that was doing things.
Yeah.
Separate them out just for concern separation. So that when the house catches on fire, you grab the hard drives and go. And you leave the Raspberry Pi.
Currently, my backup is not a whole array. It's not it's just a simple time capsule. So that's actually pretty quick to
one
grab.
Drive? So what happens when that drive dies?
Well, that's what a backup is. Right. I have my laptop. It's a primary thing. If this goes down, then I need the time capsule. So,
well, I'm pretty sold on this right now. I'm liking it a lot. I'll probably invite them on the show relatively soon just to talk a bit more about the product. I would love you to be on there and be the reasonable person saying, no, it's a bad idea. And we'll see how much trouble I get into.
I believe the term for that is naysayer.
And of course, when you are compiling, this is an ARM processor in that side of that box. So when you do compile stuff for it, you have to compile it for ARM, which means you need to, it's kind of a pain.
You have a cross compiler. I mean, that works a lot of times.
Now I'm not sure that's true. I think I had a virtualization to compile to because it was a raw. No, it's not. It's Intel based. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I honestly did wonder about, like, should I just install the cross compiler and get that working? And then I started remembering, like, a Raspberry Pi is $35.
Yeah.
And I have, you know, an AC adapter that has micro USB. Like, it was hard for me to – and I have spare SD cards. Like,
yeah,
you end up with memory cards.
Yeah.
So
I got to say that one of the things that happened to me, like, this – my old Drobo had four slots in it, and I had 2 terabyte drives in it. And that was just a FireWire box, right, for data storage. This new thing had 5 slots in it, right? So I threw the 4 drives in it, and it's booting up and stuff. I'm like, hang on a second. And I look around, and I've got an old 1.5 terabyte drive that I'm not using. And I just stuck it in, and it just added to the array. It's pretty cool.
Oh, because it's doing it as like just a bunch of drives or?
It has – I don't know exactly.
Oh, that's right. We talked about this when they had them on the show before. They do
their own thing. Yeah. Yeah, they do. And they'll the one thing I don't like is that it tells you virtually what size – it says what the size it reports through sharing is the size if you filled it up with 8-terabyte drives. So it says that I've got like 70 terabytes available, right? And I don't like that.
Yeah, I don't like that it lies to you, but the idea being that in the future as you're upgrading, you never have to reconfigure everything. It will always look the same to your users.
Right. And if you run the dashboard on your machine, it does tell you how much space is actually available.
But you have to run the dashboard, and I don't like having to run someone else's software to tell me how much space I have on my hard drive.
Yes, I agree. And that's one of the things I'll pester them about. I don't like that aspect. I think when we first had them on the show, didn't you review a unit?
I did. And I'm a little bummed that hasn't changed, although it doesn't really surprise me all that much because
it's a lot easier.
Ultimately, the operating system either supports it or it doesn't. And it could support it in multiple ways. One is it could know how to speak to Drobos. Or two, your file system could be such that it supports that somehow.
Right.
Neither of those are the case. And I don't know. I don't see that changing anytime soon. But it'd be really cool if the people who work on OS X could implement that. It's probably not very hard.
The readiness system, which is now owned by Network Solutions, I think, their system in place runs a web server, an admin web server that you do all the maintenance through. So you don't have to have a client thing installed, and then it's just shares. And you can reshape the share. It has software to do that. But your operating system really doesn't know how much space is on the current share that's being given to you, which is, I think, a little bit better. All right. Are we wrapping up? We good?
I'm cool.
Yep.
All right.
See you.